This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 166.
Here's the bet we're making. Performance is tied to energy in motion, and I think of that as emotion. It is that energy that has direction. That is performance. So the idea was, what if we actually flip the equation or the fraction? And now it's emotion over rational. If you know your math, you know I'm a math guy. The smaller your denominator, the bigger the fraction. Can we get this idea of energy and motion, which now I'm saying that's belonging. Belonging is the unlock there. It is to discretionary effort. So here's the simple math. Define the drivers, activate the actual leader and employee actions, and then track the performance curve. The bet here, a store where people feel valued, heard, stretched, equates to higher sales. That is what we're going after. Here's some early things that we're finding out, though. There is a correlation to what I call care and connection. And there is something very special. If you just put it in simplest terms, extra effort, discretionary effort, is tied to the believability that you matter. So when you look at our top performing stores, it's not just the technical competence that sets them apart. We're finding as leaders and teams that pair that operational excellence with the genuine care for people on an ongoing willingness to get better every day, they win. They really win.
How can belonging unlock performance? Why should we focus on activation, not empowerment, to drive innovation? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott. And this is the Future of HR Podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. Over the past 3 years on Future of HR, I've talked with more than 150 CHROs and HR thought leaders about what separates good HR leaders from great ones. And one thing's clear, the best HR leaders see themselves as business leaders with HR expertise. But here's the challenge. Most HR leaders aren't taught to think, communicate, and operate that way. That's why I've created the NextGen HR Accelerator, a four-week intensive live virtual development experience designed specifically for HR directors and senior managers who want to have more impact and influence. After 4 weeks of focused learning, participants continue their development journey with a 360-degree assessment, two coaching sessions with me, and peer learning with HR leaders from top companies. Over the course of the program, we focus on building your business and financial acumen, thinking strategically, influencing executives with impact, and creating HR strategies that deliver measurable business results. Over 100 HR leaders from companies like Nike, Prudential, AbbVie, McDonald's, Cardinal Health, Verizon, Corning, and more have graduated from the program, and now it's your turn. Our next cohort starts January 27th, and enrollment closes January 14th. With limited space available. This isn't just about your next role. It's about shaping the kind of HR leader you want to be. If you're ready to take the next step in your HR career, visit futureofhr.com. And if you're a CHRO, you already know your team's impact shapes the future of your organization. That's why I also partner with companies to design custom HR capability programs that build these skills at scale. You can learn more at futureofhr.com. And with that, my guest this week is Brian Miller. Brian's the Chief Talent and D&I Officer at Levi Strauss & Company, where he leads their Global Talent Inclusion and Organizational Effectiveness team. In this role, Brian's focused on designing a nimble, high-performing culture that reinforces belonging, elevates leadership, and activates teams to deliver business impact. Prior to Levi's, Brian served as the Chief Talent and Inclusion Officer at Adobe, Chief People Officer at Impossible Foods, and held senior leadership roles at Gilead Sciences and Modern Exec Solutions. And in getting to know Brian, what has impressed me the most is that he is not only strategic, but he's also operational. While many leaders excel at one or the other, Brian has the unique ability to develop the vision and then the plan to bring it to life. And I think you're going to see that in our conversation as we discussed how belonging drives performance by creating cultures where people feel valued, heard, and stretched, why he believes activation is more important than empowerment, why believability is becoming a critical measure of modern leadership, how AI-driven talent analytics unlocks HR's next opportunity, and what it means to intentionally build belonging, not just measure it. I'd love to hear your thoughts in this episode, so drop me a line on LinkedIn and say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Brian. Brian, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm glad we are doing this, JP. I'm really looking forward to the conversation. I really am.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, we've been talking about doing this for a while. It's great to finally have that conversation and share a little bit more about your career. I think your business first mindset, some insights and advice for HR leaders. So I'm excited about it. The first question I had for you, though, looking back and getting to know you, Brian, you've had a really incredible career. You work for some incredible companies, Gilead Sciences, Adobe, Impossible Foods. You've been a CHRO, head of talent. You've been in consulting for a little bit in Modern Exec, and now Levi's. It's a pretty amazing roster of companies. But as you think about all those experiences, is there one or two pivotal moments or companies that really helped shape you as a leader and how you think about HR today?
It's a really good question. And that list is making me a little embarrassed there, a little bit on the list. But here are the ones that stand out for me. Let me start with Gilead. Gilead really changed me. During my time there, Gilead cured hepatitis C, launched a drug called Sovaldi, and turned this sort of devastating lifelong disease into something that was livable. It's a cure. It's the first time I've been in a company where a cure was actually delivered. And what it taught me is the work we do really does matter. When you think about talent and culture, you can align to a company that really delivers something special. Now, Adobe taught me scale. How do you really drive values of creativity for all in a global business? Impossible Foods, though, as a CHRO, that was all about grit and urgency. That's a hyper-growth, mission-driven culture in a startup during a pandemic. And it's just not for the faint of heart. That wasn't the easiest time, but boy, I took away some great lessons. And Levi's is special to me. It gave me belonging and transformation. It's pushing me to think about a heritage brand and how do you embed courage and performance and resiliency. So these are the things that have shaped me as a leader, for sure.
I love the stories, and I think you're right with Gilead. What an example of a lot of times we think, well, we're in business to make money and to serve a customer, et cetera. But that's a situation where you cured something. And that team and the talent you put together, yeah, maybe you weren't on the football field. Like you didn't design the molecules and the drugs. But you know what? You're in the stands and you were helping out. You were cleaning up. You're part of the team. Like you get a ring. That's really amazing. All these companies are really iconic. And Levi's for me too is one of these companies where it is just an iconic American company. The brand is around toughness and just Americana. And it's interesting. What are some of the things you really enjoyed about working at Levi's and about the culture that maybe surprised you?
What surprised me about Levi's is just what you said. It is an iconic brand that most folks don't know the deep history it has in its community. Its impact, I think, on society is often not as loud. It's a humble company for sure. And when I really started to research Levi's, what you find out is it's a company that stands its ground. It's a company that tends to really believe in profits through principles in a very genuine way. So it was one of the first companies to actually desegregate on its shop floors. One of the first companies to actually make sure that they have partner rights and benefits in the community. I consider it a stalwart and a grounding force in San Francisco. It's one of the few companies who refuses to leave the city. Even better yet, it is actually investing in the city. Levi's Plaza just went through an entire renovation, adding more investment into that plaza to make it even more attractive, more beautiful, more inviting. It is a special place. It's a special brand for sure.
Yeah, that's incredible. Really actually interesting to hear a little bit more about that because I think you can feel that with the brand. But I have seen it show up over the last 5 years in a really authentic way, standing for their purpose, not just profits. Now, you've been a people leader for a while. You've obviously led talent, you've led HR. I'm curious, as you think back over your career, is there one lesson that maybe you wished you learned earlier as a people leader?
It's this reflective moment I've been having lately about leadership. Here's something that's going to sound very sort of cliche. Leadership is not about being the smartest person in the room. And we hear that a lot. I would say you have to couple that with the art and science that questions matter. And I go, there is what I have now reflected on and learned the most. It's the what and how you approach a question. JP, the longer I do this, I realize that great leaders, they create this space of curiosity, the ability to see it and say it. And what I mean by that, you can see the possible and declare a point of view. And that comes through this idea of embracing questions. I truly believe high-gain questions are the foundation for what I'm calling performance without permission. Now, I wish I had learned that earlier. I'm kind of hitting my Yoda moments now, and I'm not hitting my Ozempic moments, by the way. I'm hitting my Yoda moments right now, but I wish I learned that earlier.
I love it. Yeah, your Yoda moments, right? Well, that's why you're in the podcast, right? And I love that. So performance without permission. Tell us more about that. I love that.
Yeah, it's this idea of the more we can get employees to come away from another, I believe, often used word, not good or bad, which is empowerment. So we use this word in the narrative lately and for a long time, and turning that word into activating. So I go, it's not empowerment. I want to activate your ability to make a difference. I want to activate performance. And in doing that, empowerment feels like I had to give you permission. It's like, I'm empowering you. I'm like, no, it is performance without permission. Your ability to activate and go. That's the anchor in that one.
What's built in there is that agency, to your point of make the decision, move forward, right? And I think a lot of times in a lot of our hierarchical organizations, we say empowerment, but what we mean is still send me the email, check, copy me on that versus just, hey, you know what you need to do, go do that. And in a company like Levi's, that's even probably more critical because you've got to really out and activate for the customer, right? Whether that's in a retail store or through your different channels and how you sell, you want people to think about the customer and make those decisions quickly. People aren't going to wait. Right? They want to know. So I love that.
JP, you're spot on. This idea of creating pace, creating velocity, and how do you create as less friction to that as possible? You're spot on that one.
All right. Well, I think people might be saying performance without permission going after the podcast. That could be a good catchphrase, Brian.
I'm trademark and I want my money.
Yeah, trademark that for sure. Get that on a coffee mug. We'll get that out real quick.
T-shirt.
Now, you're also doing some really cool work at Levi's, and you talk about is belonging by design. It's belonging by design work. Tell us more about kind of what made you realize that traditional engagement surveys weren't really getting to the heart of what drives performance. And that's why you're thinking about this as belonging by design.
It's another phrase that we've anchored into Levi's as well, belonging by design. So let's reel it back a little bit and talk about engagement surveys. Let's start with that one. So engagement surveys usually tell you how people feel, not what really matters, was the anchor I was going for. So I saw an opportunity to really go back to first principles, something else I'll probably come back to. This idea of first principles really matter. So here's this old school versus new school thinking is where my head was going. The original engagement definition is defined as rational commitment over emotional commitment to drive discretionary effort. what has happened along the way as practitioners, I think we've leaned hard into rational over emotional to drive intent to stay, which is actually a rational way of thinking about it. It's intent to stay. Would you recommend? Are you satisfied? Which is tied to turnover. And am I having a happy culture? There's where as practitioners, we've really leaned hard. Now, here's the so what. I believe to move a business, it's tied to performance. Here's the bet we're making. Performance is tied to energy in motion. And I think of that as emotion. It is that energy that has direction. That is performance. So the idea was, what if we actually flip the equation or the fraction? And now it's emotion over rational. If you know your math, you know I'm a math guy. The smaller your denominator, the bigger the fraction. Can we get this idea of energy and motion, which now I'm saying that's belonging. The belonging is the unlock there. It is to discretionary effort. So here's the simple math. Define the drivers, activate the actual leader and employee actions, and then track the performance curve. The bet here, a store where people feel valued, heard, stretched, equates to higher sales. That is what we're going after.
Got it. So really, instead of like the end game being, hey, our engagement score has gone up. We went from 77 to 82% engaged. Awesome. You're saying, are the emotions and the engagement levels, the way people are feeling about the work, is that actually driving performance? And you're trying to actually connect engagement to actual performance at the store level, I'm assuming, right? We're talking about retail stores mostly.
Yes.
I think it's great. I think that's amazing because I think we haven't done enough of that. And you're right. You know, we'll get too geeky on this, but my dissertation was on commitment, on employee commitment in Taco Bell's. I actually did Taco Bell. We did research, but this is before engagement was a thing. And there's three types of commitment. There's one's emotional, effective commitment. There's continuance commitment, which is like a sunk cost. Like, do I have a 401k or do I lose something from leaving this job? And then there was a commitment around how you feel about people you work with. And what we found at Taco Bell, the only thing in my dissertation that was actually statistically significant was people were committed to who they work for. So they didn't feel a big commitment to Taco Bell because they could go get another job down the street making a quarter or a dollar more. They didn't have a sunk cost. But man, if they didn't show up on a Tuesday and there's a big rush at lunchtime, and now, Brian, you're working a lot harder than you should be because you're short-staffed, they felt bad about that. What you start to find was, to your point, like getting to the emotional piece is critical because that's actually what drives a lot of people's commitment to show up and perform for the customer, right? You want to deliver for the team. But you're now just trying to quantify that with the math, with the actual performance, which is terrific. So how's that going? And tell us, what are you finding? I know you've been working with some pretty big data scientists and you guys are getting into the math. And hopefully you don't lose us too much, but what have you been seeing about that relationship?
I truly enjoy lowering my altitude and getting a little bit data geeky around data sciences and what correlations can we really find and whether there's p-values, et cetera. We won't go there. Here's the first thing I'll say. We are in early days of belonging by design. We got to understand what we know versus what we believe. We're about to test what we believe. We know the scores. We're testing what we believe, which is the correlation of discretionary effort to performance. Here's some early things that we're finding out, though. There is a correlation to what I call care and connection. And there is something very special. If you just put it in simplest terms, extra effort, discretionary effort, is tied to the believability that you matter. So as we were saying, that you matter means that I'm there for my team. I matter as a stylist, as a store manager, as a DM. There is where we're starting to see real correlations. So when you look at our top performing stores, it's not just the technical competence that sets them apart. We're finding as leaders and teams that pair that operational excellence with the genuine care for people on an ongoing willingness to get better every day, they win. They really win. So there's our early insight. So as we test starting next week, those are the signals we'll start to look for.
Well, two things I would say. First, I'm going to commend you and the team for trying something different. You're thinking out of the box, using first principles, but the hypothesis, you've got some data, and you're following that. And to your point of not being egotistical, you're like, look, we may find something that's not actually what we thought we'd find. And if we find that, we will adjust. And I think more HR teams need to take this approach of, hey, we're going to do experiments. We're going to pilot. We're going to learn, instead of trying to pull the playbook that we've had for the last 30 years. And that may or may not work, right? Because we know it depends on the situation. Second, I love caring connection. I think you nailed what my dissertation was about. I wish I had known you 20 plus years ago. But that is a great line, because that's exactly what really is like this X factor in a workplace. Do you feel cared for? Do you feel connected? And if you do, then I'm going to give my best effort. Now, I would actually, a third C would be care, connection, and competency, or competence. Because I think when you get to, you care and you feel connected and you're competent at what you're doing and you feel like you're doing mastery, it is an unlock like no other. That's the trifecta you're really going for.
It gets back to, you and I would start to really kind of push into, is this idea of believability. I think that is the currency now of this care, connection, and competence. It becomes a surrogate for trust almost. Believability starts to anchor you more. It's like, I truly believe you. There's a believability in what we're doing. There's a believability in the strategy, a believability that we're going to win. I think there is something there.
I think it might be a denominator in this model. I see an equation, but you're right. I think the believability is this trust factor, right? Because I think what you're saying too, especially in a retail environment, do the team members believe you care and want to create that connection, and they want to see that not only in their paycheck, but how it shows up in the day-to-day work, even more importantly. So I love where you're going with this. I think it's really fascinating. If you are an HR leader who might be in a situation where, let's say you're in retail or another distributed workforce where you've got hourly workforce, you've got some high turnover, how do you think about creating a culture that can retain that talent, but also drive a great customer experience? What are some of the tactics you guys are starting to think about implementing because of belonging by design?
The first thing I would say is, let's embrace the reality. Retail's tough. I go, that's the first thing. And you've been in it. And now I'm in it for over a year. Oh, retail's tough, especially when it comes to those things of retaining talent and really driving CX scores or customer experience scores. If I could just drive it down to a very simple yet elegant way of thinking about it, it would be focus on winning. Focus on wins. Focus on that word, win. Win to me is, and you've probably heard this, what's important now? That's the win. I would go, okay, what does that turn into when we think about belonging by design? The first day on the job, that's a win. What does that look like? That first conversation with the store manager, first recognition you get from your peers, those are the winning moments. I don't think people stay for abstract strategies. They stay because of how you make them feel. And what I would say, every shift, every week.
Maybe no one wants to hear that answer, but I think that's a really good answer, because retail's hard, but a lot of jobs are hard, and it's a daily battle. It's basically hand-to-hand combat in some ways for, if you're in a customer support role, or you're in a retail environment, a lot of things coming at you. So I love the idea that what's important now and helping people get those wins so they can feel that care connection. And now you're going to add competence to that, maybe, I don't know, but
yeah,
our capability.
You're working that in there.
You can steal it. I'm working on this. I feel like I need my own coffee mug or t-shirt. I'm not sure I can get to the Brian level, but I'm trying hard.
There you go. You said the right thing. It may sound very simple, but we don't need to complexify things as HR. We do that really well. And especially in retail, you know this, keep it simple. Keep it simple, because retail is tangible. They have real things in their hands that they're dealing with customers. And I go, it is a tangible business. It is not a conceptual business. So keep it simple and actionable.
Absolutely. Another thing you're working on at Levi's to keep simple and an important initiative is thinking about how you identify critical roles that truly create value. And I'd love, if you can, to share a little bit, nothing confidential, but share a little bit about how you guys are approaching this work and what you've learned.
This is a good one, because I'm going to start with another hard truth. The hard truth is this: not all roles are created equal. What we've decided to do is map critical roles that disproportionately drive outsized value to our strategy. Some really key insights that would some may see as obvious. Hierarchy does not equal value. It's the first thing you find out. Where you sit does not drive value. It can, but it doesn't always equate. Also, what we found out is the ability to create clarity around a critical role in a matrix, multi-brand, global, multi-geography, whatever multiples you want to put on it, that's tough. And it requires some sharp, bold thinking, as well as some smart ways of having the conversation. I'll give you an example. The ability to understand what is a value-enabling role. That's a role that probably supports scale. Okay, now I got to tell you, what's a value-protecting role? Well, that's about risk and reputation management. Okay, what about a silo-breaking role that reduces friction, that works across the business? I have to understand that. And then once you get that kind of figured out, your next level of thinking begins with, okay, give me a role health check. What's the decision rights in the role? What's the scope of the role and impact? Where does it sit in the org structure? These are the things that really shape this conversation, and we're there. I'll give you a really cool analogy because F1 is really in right now. F1, the movie's out. If you're a Brad Pitt fan, I'm a little jealous because it's Brad Pitt, but Brad Pitt's out there. But think about that sport. That sport deals with a person, the driver, and the car. And you got great drivers out there. You got Lewis Hamilton, rock star, Max Verstappen, another great. You got Charles Leclerc, we can debate. I'm an F1 fan. So you got these amazing drivers, and guess what? The car matters. The car really matters. Aerodynamics, DRS, which is drag reduction systems. You got to understand C1, C2, which are tire compounds. So what they've done is what we're actually trying to do, which is how do you balance both? How do you have a conversation that the person's great, but the role really matters as well? That's where we are in that sort of project, or that's where we are in that project, and more to come, but it's exciting work.
It's really exciting work. Thanks for the F1 reference. Definitely go check out the Netflix series. We actually went to F1 in Austin this last summer, and it was an incredible experience. I never even really knew what was going on with F1. But they drive fast. That is really fun. And then I started watching the Netflix shows, and you really get into it and see, to your point, this idea that it's the driver may be the talent, but man, if they're not driving the right car, those drivers are upset. They're mad that things aren't working well. And so I think your idea of critical roles plus a value enabler, roles that maybe are silo breakers, roles that are value brand protectors you talked about, that's pretty new thinking. Because I think typically it's like strategic, kind of core, requisite, et cetera, right? And so I love the way you're the nuance on that piece. Now, the last thing you tell me this is fair or not, Brian, but a lot of times when I talk to critical roles of people, I think there's an assumption they can do this in a 2-hour meeting, or they can send out a quick survey to their business leader and then they put it into the talent review deck. And I've been guilty of this early in my career. A long time ago, we did this work, but I don't think that's what really happens. Tell me a little, not give us all the details, but like how long does it really start to take and how many conversations to get some clarity around critical roles in your experience?
We're already 45, almost 90 days into this project. And we have just now articulated the set of roles. I won't give you how many. We've just done our first pass. And here's the process. It first starts with getting everyone on the page of just what I said. What is a critical role? Because you immediately have your assumptions about a critical role. It's this, Brian. Or my critical role, it's me. I'm an executive. I am the critical role. So it's first getting that, and then having, and I know I keep going back to this, it's having the business acumen to map that role, not just to the strategy, but I have to say, what are the value creators in the strategy? How does that role drive EBIT? How does that role actually drive disproportionate sales? How does it drive any sort of structural economics that we're doing? That now becomes a different layer. So this is where it becomes these steps that you get people to go, okay, now I truly understand what this role does or how it really affects us as a business. So yeah, we're, like I said, about 90 days in, just had our big executive leadership team meeting with CEO and direct reports, and it's not a one and done. It's a conversation. And then you get into the, like I said, the role, the health checks on the roles, the decision rights of the roles, et cetera.
Yeah, some of the things you can pull back that layer, the onion, and keep peeling back around what this looks like. What's great about critical roles, the way you're doing it, which is the right way, and for people listening, is just to remember this is a way to elevate talent to a business conversation. Because we're talking about roles that drive value creation, which means revenue or help the brand in certain ways. in some ways, just like the retail experience got a pair of jeans in someone's hands, now the leaders can see, oh, I've got the role and I understand there's a connection to what we do. And so it becomes more real for them, hopefully, as well. So I love the way you guys are doing that. Now, Brian, you're also someone who's really passionate about using data to drive HR decisions. But for HR leaders who aren't as analytically savvy, where should they start in building that muscle? Because I think it's just so critical.
This is where we're going to revisit that phrase I used before, which is the first step is really going to that first principles thinking. To me, that is stripping down the problem to its basic fundamentals. And what I think is a super great way of thinking about this for HR is this is an approach that's been used by great thinkers. Aristotle used this approach. Scientists and engineers, when they want to solve complexities, use this first principles approach. A step for HR would be, okay, for us, let's start with the provocation, I would say, the question. What is one business issue that's creating the most friction to the escape velocity we want on a strategy or the strategy? And then I would say, add to that, what are the people, data that might help us explain it? That to me is where you start. You start with the ability to be very curious. My advice then to my peers would be curiosity always wins before perfection. Get that question really, really laid out. And that will get you to your analytics. That will get you to your data. But it is that curiosity around that business question.
Yeah, I love that. I'm glad you didn't go to dashboards. You said, hey, look, dashboards are nice, but what's the question behind the dashboard, right? Get really clear on that question. And I think it might lead you down a totally different path like you guys are doing on belonging or even critical roles. What about some opportunities around how HR is using data and analytics to drive business impact? Are there things we're not doing today? Like, what should we be doing that we're just not?
I think our unlock for HR on data analytics, or our biggest opportunity would be, it's AI-driven analytics on the talent flow. With AI coming, why wouldn't we layer that capability against the actual talent flow that we're trying to affect? Here, and I'll go into that. I truly believe we're still too reactive. We lost a person, now what? That is the frame that I often hear. We lost someone, what do we do? This opportunity to anticipate, this opportunity to really map out weak signals, to mitigate business disruption, to smooth out volatility curves. Other functions do this. And this is what surprised me. You'll see this in the actual supply chain function, manufacturing function, commercial forecasting, marketing chasing trends and CX scores. Why not in talent? Think about what we could be doing. Why wouldn't we have a discretionary effort index that's tied to CX scores as a predictive model? Why wouldn't we have a decision velocity index that says, okay, what's our speed of decision and how does that affect revenue, EBIT, et cetera, margin? It's this idea of talent as a predictive engine for brand, for culture, for growth. That's our biggest opportunity.
Brian, last question for you. What is one word or phrase you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, this is a fun one. And you had a goddess of design on your podcast called Amy Cates. I'm still a little bit, I believe the one word is design. We've been administrators in HR. We've been partners in HR. The next era is design for us. It's designing talent. It's designing organizational performance that fuels growth. I really believe that we must be the architects of how work gets done. It's that straightforward.
I love it. The future of HR is all about design and designing the future of work. Brian, thank you so much for being on the Future of HR podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, JP. Really appreciate it. Had a lot of fun.
Me too. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR podcast. Thanks to Brian for joining me to share how HR can design for what's important now, linking belonging, leadership, and business performance to the future of work. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, I think you'll enjoy my Future of HR newsletter, which is the only newsletter that's focused on helping you to elevate your career and business impact. Go to futureofhr.com to subscribe and be sure to download my HR Leaders Blueprint, which is 18 pages of real-world advice from 100-plus HR thought leaders with simple, actual, and proven strategies to advance your career. And we'll be back next week with two incredible guests, Jennifer Wilson and Brad Warga, who are partners and global co-heads of Human Resources Officers Practice at Heidrick & Struggles, one of the world's leading executive search and leadership advisory firms. Together, Brad and Jennifer advise CEOs and boards on placing the world's top CHROs, giving them a unique perspective on how the role of HR leadership is evolving at the highest levels. If you ever wondered what separates the most in-demand HR leaders from the rest, this is a conversation you will not want to miss. Thanks again for being part of the Future of HR community.